Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is David Thoreau, and I'm the president of the Independent Institute. I'm delighted to welcome you all to our Independent Policy Forum luncheon today. As many of you know, the Institute regularly sponsors programs featuring outstanding speakers, although our speaker today is particularly outstanding. For those of you new to the Institute, you will find background information at your seat. I'm sure most of you have seen it. The Institute, for those of you who are new to our program, is a nonprofit, non-politicized scholarly research and educational foundation. We sponsor comprehensive studies on many public issues. The intent of our program is to adhere to the highest standards of independent inquiry, and the resulting studies are widely distributed as books and other publications, and are publicly debated through numerous conference and media programs, such as the luncheon we're holding today. Our purpose at the Institute is actually a Jeffersonian one. Jefferson prided himself in desiring to seek the truth in many areas, including the impact of government policies, and not necessarily just to tell people what they might want to hear. In so doing, we will not take the public pronouncements of government officials at face value, nor the conventional wisdom over serious public issues. Hence, we invite your involvement, but be prepared for new and challenging perspectives. The Institute neither seeks nor accepts government funding, but draws its support from a diverse range of foundations, businesses, and individuals. And we invite each of you to become a member. In your packet, you'll find benefits of becoming a member of the Institute, including receiving a copy of our widely acclaimed book, Out of Work, on the issue of unemployment and the economy. In addition, you may be interested in a catalog review that we produce called Liberty Tree. And Liberty Tree features many books in economics, entrepreneurship, and many public issues. I also wanted to thank the members of our host committee who very graciously joined, and their support and assistance was essential to make this program possible today. As you all know, here in California, we're experiencing unprecedented change as a rather anemic economic recovery continues. But change is today's constant in any industry you can name. Half of the Fortune 500 companies in 1980 fell off the list by 1990, and the trend seems to be accelerating. And although during this period, American business as a whole created some 20 million jobs, new jobs, the Fortune 500 actually lost 3 million jobs. Today's global marketplace is demanding radical business change just to survive. At this special Independent Policy Forum, a decade after his landmark book, In Search of Excellence, our speaker today, Tom Peters, will draw upon his newest bestseller, which was just recently released in a softcover edition. And I strongly encourage anyone here to get a copy before you leave. We also have copies of his book, Thriving on Chaos. In liberation management, we see that any business firm must increasingly be in the knowledge extraction, integration, and application business, regardless of what product or service it may be focusing on. Today's biggest companies are dismembering themselves voluntarily in record numbers just to compete. Management is flattening itself out as far as organizational structure is concerned, linking everyone in any firm that will succeed, into each function and then linking itself directly to the customer. One of the lessons I think that we've been learning and that is a focus of Tom's book is that centralized bureaucracies in business as well as in government simply can no longer excel. The new knowledge workers must be liberated, so to speak, to operate in fast, non-bureaucratic information networks and project teams. Workers aiming to thrive must become self-starters, constantly retraining themselves with employers facilitating the new entrepreneurship. Business strategy is becoming the purview of moderate-sized, highly accountable entrepreneurial business units that are very, very close to the marketplace. And through this marketizing of the firm, government bureaucracies must be curtailed in their constraints on entrepreneurship and innovation. We're delighted to be sponsoring this special program today. More than anyone, Tom Peters has demonstrated in his best-selling books, tapes, and seminars how to implement the dynamics of business entrepreneurship, of organizing people in service to the customer. His book, In Search of Excellence, co-authored with Robert Waterman, created a worldwide sensation, and his subsequent books have searched out and championed pioneering patterns for business excellence. Tom is the entrepreneur of entrepreneurship. But in liberation management, Tom Peters has further integrated far more, including the work of the late Nobel laureate free market economist F.A. Hayek, along with the global high-tech revolution and the many new managerial innovations arising in firms around the world. Those of you not familiar with this economist Hayek was clearly one of the greatest economists and political philosophers of this century. He, along with his mentor Ludwig von Mises of the so-called Austrian School of Economics, which was founded in Vienna in 1871, developed a very refined understanding of the market process itself and how entrepreneurship is the driving force of human progress. What distinguished this school of thought then and now from the dominant collectivist view of most of traditional academia has been its recognition that the intricacies of all social and economic interaction stem from the choices and actions of individuals who serve as entrepreneurs for change. Hayek further showed how markets stood in decisive contrast to the dysfunctional nation workings of government bureaucracy and state planning, whose revenues and operations reside insulated from the normal accountability to customers that every firm must attend to if it is to survive in a freely competitive market. It is fitting that this year marks the 50th anniversary of Hayek's international bestseller, The Road to Serfdom, which made him famous in 1944 and thereafter. The book first called the world's attention to the dangers of economically and politically centralization of power in state bureaucracy, regardless of party. This and later books, including his brilliant The Fatal Conceit, has fostered sort of a neoliberal, neoclassical liberal revolution based on the work of figures such as Locke, Jefferson, and Adam Smith, which has spread worldwide. We all know, of course, of the changes in the Soviet bloc, but economic liberalization is a trend we're finding everywhere almost, in Europe, South America, you name it. And in the United States, this movement for decentralization and individual economic and civil liberties continues apace, despite perhaps the current nostalgia in Washington for the 1930s heyday of central planning and so many policy initiatives. Now in liberation management, Tom Peters has dedicated the book in part to Hayek for his devotion to markets and entrepreneurship. Before Tom Peters wrote In Search of Excellence, business books rarely made it to national bestseller lists and certainly never really to the top of the list. But beginning in the mid-1980s, Tom's books, including A Passion for Excellence and Thriving on Chaos, were on the New York Times nonfiction list for 7 years running. Each book has been translated into a dozen or more languages and has been a bestseller from Malaysia, Japan, Australia, and China, to Ireland, Sweden, Brazil, and beyond. And liberation management, as I said, continues in its new edition. The Christian Science Monitor has called Tom the grand guru of management success, and Newsday describes him as chief executive of Excellence Incorporated. He's a member of the board of advisors of the Independent Institute. He's the founder of the Tom Peters Group, three training and communications companies located in Palo Alto, California. He also writes a weekly syndicated column for the Tribune Media Service. He's authored many, many articles, including the one in the January issue of CIO, which is in your packet. Tom was a principal of McKinsey & Company from 1974 to 81, becoming a partner in 1977. His degrees are in engineering from Cornell University and from Stanford, where he got his PhD in business. It's a distinct pleasure for me to introduce him now to speak on new opportunities for excellence in a freer world, after which I'm sure he'd be delighted to answer questions and maybe even interview or rather autograph a few books. May I proudly present Tom Peters.
Thank you, David, for those kind words. It is a pleasure to be here with you this afternoon. I didn't tell David one thing, and that is that, in fact, there is yet another book which is coming out. And it's rather appropriate relative to the message that I want to discuss today, because, in fact, my experience in book publishing, and perhaps some of you have had similar experiences directly or indirectly, is that one turns over one's manuscript to the publisher on a given day, and then magically, with magic being the appropriate word, because none of us, at least in my colleague set, ever understood it, magically, 6 months later, the book appears. And I assumed that there was an iron law of book gestation that was associated with that. Consistent with the themes that David, myself, and many others support, we decided with the new book that we would get involved in a larger part of the process ourselves, using independent contractors to work on various parts of the activity. In particular, we turned to a magazine designer because it didn't seem necessarily true to us that books should be quite as boring as they typically are. And we worked with the magazine designer and we talked to him about deadlines. And I think for a long period of time, he thought that we were speaking to him in a foreign language because we kept talking about months and he kept talking about hours. The publisher would give him, as a possible schedule window, 2 months to work on a task. And he would say, well, normally that takes me about 4 hours. Why do I have to take 2 months? Which I was sympathetic to because I was paying the bill. The long and short of it is that on Sunday night, this past Sunday night, we turned over, using the new language, the final manuscript to the publisher, and books will begin their trip from the factory to the bookstores approximately at noon next Tuesday. It was an interesting experience, to put it mildly. Another way of saying there are different ways to skin cats. And in fact, the reason that there is a new book is precisely that. I would like to think that each of the succeeding books that I've released have turned up the heat under this central entrepreneurial message. And I thought that I had gone about as far as I could go with liberation management, but I don't think so at all. And today, in fact, what I want to talk with you about is this new world and an even more entrepreneurial vision for corporations and perhaps a little bit beyond that. The changing nature of the economy, in a way, accidentally came home to me last October the 18th. I was giving a speech somewhere, a city with which I am very familiar, and under my hotel room door that morning were two newspapers. There was the salmon-colored copy of the Financial Times, and the headline there said 400,000 European auto parts workers' jobs in jeopardy. And indeed, they were, as one followed the logic of the article, because European auto part maker productivity is running nearly one-third of that of the Japanese and about two-thirds of that of the U.S. So 400,000 European workers woke up with a hangover, to put it mildly, on October the 18th. At least one person
had a good day that day, because the other academic journal that was under my door was USA Today. And there, the headline, though I was somewhere in the Midwest, I think at the time, came from a little bit closer to home. It talked about a young man, age 20, who bounces spheroids for a living. This spheroid bouncer had at that moment never bounced a spheroid professionally. And yet our very own Golden State Warriors found it to be a sensible economic decision, and indeed, as we look at the coming playoffs, it looks that way, to offer young Chris Webber $74.4 million for the potential of 15 years of his service. Now, I love that story. I'm not happy, obviously, for the 400,000 European auto workers, but it does speak to this phenomenal, dramatic, incredible change in today's economy, where literally in an interview in the Harvard Business Review about, oh, I don't know, 2 or 3 months ago, the chief executive officer of Silicon Graphics, perhaps the leader in sophisticated workstations, workstation hardware, Ed McCracken said, well, look, we are led to the future by our leading edge customers. He explained that leading edge customers used to mean such organizations as the United States Air Force. He now said the perfect definition of the leading edge customer, from right up the road a little bit, is naturally and of course industrial light and magic, the special effects folks in what is the largest industry in the world, entertainment. And so we are watching a shift in the economy, which frankly, in most of my travels, sometimes even in the Bay Area, but outside of the Bay Area, makes people very nervous. I can assure you I was not invited back to speak to the Detroit Economic Club when I said to them, if you could only get your trade balance up to where Madonna's is. About two-thirds of her revenue come from offshore, and you cannot say the same about that of General Motors, Chrysler, and Ford, despite indeed the dramatic improvements that they have made. Look, the point to me is very simple, and it's terribly important. It's abstract, and it's the most pragmatic point of all. I think you would have to be a total idiot, and I think I mean that quite literally, not to agree that we're in the midst of the most dramatic change in the way commerce has done in the last couple of hundred years. Could there be any question whatsoever that this is the biggest change since people came off of the farms into the cities? I don't think there could be. Now, to me, that is a very, very practical statement. It's a practical statement in the sense that I can understand at the age of 51 language like, this is the biggest deal since the end of World War II. This is the biggest deal since my father's time. If I stretch, maybe I can even think in terms of this is the biggest deal since my grandfather's time. But what does it mean to be part of, in the midst of, trapped by being exactly the wrong word in my language, in my belief, the biggest change in 200 years? What it means, quite simply, and this really is the entrepreneurial bedrock logic, nobody knows what the hell they're doing. There are no gurus. There are no experts. I don't believe a word that I'm saying. But if we don't have a clue, which I think is a legitimate state, then that suggests that the only guaranteed mistake is not to try stuff. Yesterday morning, I spoke to the Newspaper Association of America, and that's precisely what I said to them. I said, I don't know what the hell's going to happen to the information highway. Don't ask me. I said, the only thing I can guarantee you is that if you don't get your toes wet, your ankles wet, your knees wet, and your entire body wet, and if you don't make a complete ass out of yourself in the course of the next couple of years, you haven't got a snowball's chance of participating in this activity. And I said to them, I know why you're going to fail. You are going to fail because you are not going to fail with sufficient bravura. And out there somewhere are another 10 or 110 or 1,010 would-be Teddy Turners 109 of out of every 110 of whom will fail, which is totally irrelevant, and one out of every 110 of whom, like Ted Turner, will completely redefine the name of the business. And I said, your problem is that if Ted Turner applied to you for a job, he wouldn't get past the first 6 minutes of the interview. And I think that really is the critical issue. The point being then that my message in a nutshell for us, even in this absolutely fabulously exciting Bay Area, and I remain as bullish on California as anybody possibly could, I think the greatest thing that's happened to us in a lot of respects is that we are reducing our dependency on the big defense industries in Southern California and so on. And if both the right and the left can get it out of their heads to quit knocking immigrants and we continue to let the Vietnamese and the Hispanics and everybody else in the world do their thing, we've got a brilliant future. We've got a brilliant future. Well, what kind of a world is it? I had to make a potential deal with the devil a few months ago, and it turned out all right, I'm delighted to say. I was giving a seminar in London, and at the seminar, one of the sets of participants was from a company called, consortia called Inmarsat, International Marine Satellite Corporation. And after my seminar, the chief executive officer came up to me and he said, Tom, I will make you a deal. I use, as you will see in a moment, 35 millimeter slides to illustrate my presentations. And he said, I will send you my favorite slide if you will agree to use it first in your presentations. And I said, well, tell me what the hell is on it. And he said, no. I said, how can I promise? He said, it's very simple. You don't get the slide if you don't make the promise. And he was an interesting guy, and so I decided, somewhat reluctantly, that I would make him the deal. Well, he sent me the slide, and it was indeed the appropriate one to begin a presentation with today. I hope those of you to my left can see it at least a little bit. The slide, quite simply, is an Inmarsat satellite attached to the back of an elephant several hundred miles from the end of nowhere. Ladies and gentlemen, the global village has arrived. The truth of the matter is, the thing that David and I and those associated with the Independent Institute believe in, associated with freer trade and so on and so forth, is something that we should get ourselves worked up about, something that we should worry about. But the real secret that we can't allow out of this room is that satellites on the back of elephants make most of what governments do totally irrelevant. That can't be stopped by any set of regulators. And so we are in an environment where literally the world is at our fingertips. It is a scary environment. It is a terrifying environment. I was in India a couple of months after receiving this, and one of my stops was in Bangalore, India. And among other things in Bangalore, the Motorola company has a software design center which is creating sophisticated software for its advanced Iridium wireless world satellite communication system. Not only were they doing sophisticated and advanced software design there, but the little Motorola center there had just been certified by the Carnegie Mellon's Software Certification Institute as having designed the highest quality software that anybody had ever recorded. As I said to a group of very conservative business people in small manufacturing companies a few weeks later at a seminar in the United States, this is going to come as a surprise to you, but they ain't all making sandals over there. And that is, again, the nature of this beast. Liberation Management, in its hardback form, weighed 3.25 pounds and took 763 pages to get out of my system. As one reviewer said, if you don't like the book, it makes a hell of a paperweight. Being a believer in free markets, I said, I don't give a damn whether you read the book or use it as a paperweight. The royalties are the same. The truth of the matter is, which I'm loath to admit, especially since some of you haven't yet bought your paperback copies, is that I can summarize the 763 pages in six words. And the six words are right here. Crazy times call for crazy organizations. In fact, so much do I believe that the title of the new book, which is printed in purple and yellow on the cover, is Crazy Times Call for Crazy Organizations. We turned up the heat as hard as we could in liberation management, as I said a minute ago. And yet, frankly, the thing which has been keeping me awake at night for the last 15, 16, 18, 20 months since that book was sent off to the publisher is the fact that here in 1994 or 1993, when I began to scratch this particular itch, companies are still phenomenally boring in terms of trying to deal with a phenomenally unboring time. For in fact, this sentence, though it uses the C word, crazy, twice, is the antithesis of a crazy sentence. It is a cold, calculative, linear, logical, rational, Cartesian sentence that even a Frenchman could love. There is no doubt whatsoever about the first two words of the sentence. It is crazy time. None of us would deny that. If I can hook you, as it were, intellectually onto the first two words of that sentence, then I've got you. Because it is clear, is it not, if the times are mad, that our organizations, organizational structures, and organizational arrangements to deal with those times must be as well. This is the symbol which runs through the new book. It is not a time of change. It is a time of revolution. Anaki Lopez, sometimes loved, sometimes hated, former General Motors, now with Volkswagen, spoke to European automakers in the late fall of 1993, and he said, the time for Kaizen, the Japanese word for constant improvement that most of us, many of us, are practicing in our companies. He said, the time for Kaizen is past. It is the time for quantum leaps, not 5 or 6 or 7% a year, but 30 or 40 or 50 or 60% a year. And I think that he is precisely right. We have spent the 1980s, and God bless us, it paid off, learning about constant improvement. It is a fabulously important idea. Most of us are not doing it well enough. And yet, even if we were doing it very well, it is not enough. It is not nearly enough. You know, it's funny how these things basically come home to you, come home to all of us, I think, in personal ways. And the experience I had that was kind of my certification of all of this came last June. I had decided that the time had finally come to get a laptop computer. I was, in part, I've been programming since 1965, but I was, you know, I charged a lot of money for my seminars, and I was getting nervous about being the only businessman flying in the front of the plane without a laptop. You know, that way people thought some potential customer is going to see me and I'm going to be in deep yogurt. And I figured I could program it with a few games anyway and have a nicer flight. So I decided to get my laptop, did a little bit of research, and decided that the best that I could possibly do in every sense of the word would be to get myself an Apple PowerBook 165C. Which indeed I acquired. I made one small mistake, and that is I did not consult with the in-house consultant, namely my 27-year-old son. So I brought my PowerBook home, proud as a peacock, particularly at my own newfound independence of doing such things, and I said to Rob, look at what I got. I got a 165C. Isn't it a beauty? Now, any number of you are parents, and you know that uniquely contemptuous look with which a child can eyeball his or her parent. Rob looked at me, his lips curled. I don't really think they did, but that's the way it looked from where I was. And he said, oh, how nice. You got one of the antiques. He said, I think it's been out now for nearly 120 days. Now, he's a smart kid, and he realized the insanity of what he had said before the words escaped from his lips, and so he grinned. The truth of the matter is, grin or not, he was right. In June, I bought my Apple 165C. It had been announced in March, and lo and behold, on December the 1st of 1993, Apple did discontinue it as an antique. But literally, we are in an environment today, whether we're talking about grocery store products, financial services products, or hardware from Apple Computer, where something that is 90 days old can legitimately be called worthy of insertion in the Smithsonian Institute. And that is the nature of the beast, and I would suggest it goes significantly beyond the word change. I wave my arms around. I raise my voice. Peter Drucker does neither. Peter Drucker is given to understatement, and that is an overstatement. Peter, writing about a year or so ago in the Harvard Business Review, said, every organization has to prepare for the abandonment of everything it does. That is not a mellow statement. Reading in unison, Mr. Drucker did not say the average organization should be prepared to experience significant change in the midst of a turbulent environment. No, no, no. The key words in that sentence are three: every, everything, and abandon. I mean, to the best of my knowledge of the English language, you can't go much further than those three words. And yet I suggest that the perennial understater, Mr. Drucker, has got it exactly right. Well, what does that mean? Yes, indeed, as David said, I've been yelling and screaming about flattening bureaucracies now for 10 or 12 or 15 years. I remember standing at podiums like this 7, 8, 9, maybe 5, 6 years ago, begging and pleading with executives, please expand your span of control from 1 to 7 up to 1 to 15. And I would get these terrified looks. 1 to 15? I don't like that number very much. Our friends down south in Palo Alto, Hewlett Packard, are making a ton of money in the printer business these days. One of the most profitable parts of the HP operation is the HP inkjet printer operation out in Colorado. 9,000 employees, pretty good number. Corporate headquarters, if we must use that term, 4 people. The person who runs it, his chief of research and development, and 2 administrative assistants. Then there's this fraction. In Liberation Management, I featured a sea of brown Bavaria, the giant, heavy industrial, old-fashioned company headquartered in Zurich, Switzerland. Let's take a look at ABB, a sea of brown Bavaria, for a minute. And I use the example for a couple of reasons, because it's not Silicon Valley, it's not industrial light and magic, it's in heavy engineering activities where economics of scale and theory should still hold sway. Moreover, it's not an American company. The truth is, we don't hire and fire promiscuously in the United States, but everybody else in the world thinks we do. And so I chose a European company where, in fact, labor mobility is approximately zero. This fraction. Percy Barnevik is the boss of ABB, a sea of brown Bavaria. In 1980, he took over ASEA of Sweden as chief executive, inherited a corporate headquarters staff of 2,000. In the next 100 days, he reduced it from 2,000 to 100. In 1987, Barnevik merged ASEA of Sweden with Brown Bavarian Sea of Switzerland, inherited a corporate staff of 4,000. In the course of the next 6 months, reduced it to 200. Today, Mr. Barnevik runs a $30 billion heavy engineering enterprise called ABB ASEA Brown Bavaria, from a nondescript headquarters building near the train station in West Zurich, with a corporate staff of 100 professionals and 50 supporting clerical people. The logic is this: 2,000 in the headquarters staff at ASEA, 4,000 in the headquarters staff at Brown Bavarian Sea gives us 6,000 people. Corporate center today, 150. That is to say, 58.5 out of every 60 senior middle manager staff professionals were found to be excess baggage. That is the nature of attempting to compete in a flatter, more rapidly changing environment. And the logic is impeccable. In an interview that I had with Barnevik about 5 or 6 months ago to get an update, he said, Tom, it is simple. Given the production that is now coming in from all over the world, every market in which I compete is in surplus. If you are in surplus, how do you win? Quality, service, constant innovation, closer to the customer than the next person. And he said, where do those attributes come from? They come from obsessed, zealous, committed individuals. And he said, look, you're not totally stupid. Have you ever heard of an obsessed, zealous group of 5,000 people? Because the magic was that Barnevik got rid of 58 and a half out of every 60 people at the corporate headquarters, took the remaining 200,000 people, and broke heavy engineering ABBSC of Brown Boveri into 5,000 amazingly independent profit centers averaging only 40 people each. And that is his secret. I think it's the most extraordinary experiment in organizational change in a giant industry since Alfred Sloan started decentralizing General Motors back in 1920, prior to the subsequent 60 years of recentralization. So that's the beast we're talking about. I'm here to tell you in that regard that I got it wrong. I didn't get it wrong, I got it very wrong. Naturally, I'm delighted that a lot of you bought In Search of Excellence in the 1980s, but I did something in retrospect that is borderline immoral. We talked about getting closer to the customer. We talked about empowering employees. The truth of the matter is, it is virtually immoral to talk about the empowerment of employees and getting close to the customer if you're doing it in a 7-layer bureaucracy or an 8-layer bureaucracy, let alone a god-awful 18-layer bureaucracy, public or private. I put the score up here on this slide. Jack Welch 1, Tom Peters 0. The 1990s version of General Electric Chairman Jack Welch sounds like the 1980s version of Tom Peters. He talks about getting small company soul into our big company body. He talks about liberation. Well, Jack's allowed to talk about it because, in fact, during the 80s, he did the hard work of getting rid of the structural gunk that makes words like liberation and small company soul legitimate ones. Some of you may remember, it's almost been forgotten today, that in the 80s, Jack had the nickname Neutron Jack. He would visit a headquarters building of an operation, and when he left, the building would be standing, but the people would all be gone. This little piece of logic is why, precisely against the advice of everybody whose advice I seek, that if you read through Liberation Management, unlike my other books, you will find out that the first 50% of the book focuses on organizational structural issues, and not until you have waded through the hard work are you allowed to talk about the customer stuff. And I think it's the right way to go. The logic is very simple. Carl Sagan and Andrew Yan, writing in Shadows of Forgotten Ancestors, said active mutators in placid and stable times tend to die off. They are selected against. Reluctant mutators in quickly changing times are also selected against. It is arguable, David cited the statistics of the loss of 3 million jobs in the Fortune 500 while the rest of the country gained 20 million, to say that essentially even today in 1994, the average Fortune 500 firm remains a reluctant mutator in clearly very, very active times. What does it mean to go after the new opportunities? Percy Barnevik says that in a heavy engineering firm, the magic number is about 40 people. Very interesting. Except I still find, and my frustration remains almost as high as it ever was, that I still find people writing, people saying, people proclaiming regularly that, well, if we want to go after this opportunity, we need a couple $100 million for that particular startup. The Japanese have got concentrated corporate assets, and you Americans are screwing around in Silicon Valley with a bunch of half-assed entrepreneurial enterprises. It's the biggest, best half-assed on earth, incidentally. Let's look at the numbers. Inc. magazine every year publishes its list of 500 fastest-growing companies in the United States. The statistics on the chart on the screen come from the Inc. 500 list of 1992. On that list were hamburger flippers, which is not to denigrate hamburger flippers, because McDonald's today is one of the highest tech companies around. On the list are hamburger flippers, overnight express companies, biotech companies, software companies, supercomputer companies, anything you can name. And what did it cost, other than a lot of time and a lot of emotion and a lot of energy and a lot of commitment, to get them started? 34% of the Inc. 500 in 1992 was started with less than $10,000. 59% was started with less than $50,000. And fully three quarters of the Inc. 500 were started with less than $100,000. It is more than it ever has been, a magical entrepreneurial time. James Morse, writing in the Harvard Business Review a while back, put it this way. He said, the only sustainable advantage comes from out-innovating the competition. I am a fan of the total quality movement. You would be a fool not to, and it has perhaps been one of the two or three most significant things associated with improved American competitiveness in the last 15 years. Nonetheless, as the market becomes more vigorous, as software design equal to the best in the world comes from Bangalore, India, the winning formula for the years ahead, yes, it'll be good quality, yes, it'll be good service, but above all, it will be the ability, if Americans wish to retain the incredibly relatively high wage rates which we have, is innovating faster, applying brain power faster, behaving more entrepreneurially than the next guy can. There is no hiding from this global entrepreneurial revolution. And if you want to be part of it, if you want to stay where the Americans have been for a long period of time, that is, relatively speaking, at the top of the list, we've got to earn it, and then we've got to re-earn it, and then we've got to re-earn it every single passing day. Part of the key I've talked about, the de-gunking of organizations. The next piece of the puzzle, if you will, is going way beyond, in my opinion, light years beyond, at least psychologically, in my opinion, the notion of empowering employees, introducing participative management, to literally something which is closely akin to turning the average employee into an entrepreneur. Or at least, to use my language, a partial cop-out, I would admit, a 90% entrepreneur. Ralph Steyer, who runs a sausage company of great success in Wisconsin, commented, we want each person to be a business person. About, I don't know, 3-4 months ago, my plans changed at the last minute. I needed to get a hotel room, and so at 5:30 in the morning, I was calling around in the city I was going to and decided pretty much where I wanted to stay. And so I called the hotel, and I received on the other end of the line one of those absolutely fabulous audio text systems, which gave me a menu of 100,000 things to do, or so it felt, at 5:30. You know, I had a hell of a time getting a hold of a human being, but after several efforts, I did. Moreover, I got somebody at the front desk, and I said, I'd like to make a reservation for tonight. And he said, I can't help you. Despite my frustration, knowing that if you don't lose your cool, things will work out better than if you do lose your cool, therefore passing it off to my blood pressure rather than this person on the other end of the line, I said, why can't you? And he said, I'm not a reservationist. The dirtiest word in the English language, as far as I'm concerned, is the term slot filler. The most beautiful word in the English language is business person. And what I'm talking about, which again, in my mind, and I hope to explain it briefly, I'd love to have more time, but that's not really available to us. In my mind, is talking about literally turning every employee in the travel services company, in the hotel, in the software company, in the steel mill, into mom or pop of Mom and Pop Inc. The example, and what a pairing it was, David, along with F.A. Hayek on the dedication page, were a couple of frontline Teamsters from Springfield, Massachusetts, by the name of Tom Strange and Joe Tilley. Tom and Joe worked for an old line manufacturer called Tightflex in Springfield. A new boss came along in 1987, ripped out layers of bureaucracy, reorganized a 500-person unit in the course of a weekend into 6 to 10-person teams that were essentially small businesses. In the course of all that, this well-performing company got even better. In fact, it got a lot better. The average order lead time for a custom-engineered order went down from 10 to 12 weeks on average to 2 to 5 days, and that's no small thing. Nonetheless, the GE aircraft engines of the world, the NASAs of the world, the Boeings of the world would get stuck, and they needed things even faster. Enter Mr. Strange and Mr. Tilley, now called at Tightflex the RDT, or Rapid Deployment Team. Tom and Joe, a couple of frontline Teamsters, do it all. Customer contact, they plan the job, they customize the job. You heard David say it, I got 2 engineering degrees. Truth of the matter is, most of engineering is like most of getting a CPA certificate. It really ain't rocket science. It's just a thinly disguised effort to keep other people from practicing your trade. Which is to say that Tom and Joe can do most of the engineering. They execute the order, that is, they build the hose, and they take it to the loading dock, and occasionally they take it to the customer. Tom and Joe are not empowered employees. Tom and Joe are Tom and Joe Incorporated, a 2-person mom and pop shop working within this 500-person company, which incidentally is a very autonomous unit of Britain's TI group itself. I started looking at these guys and saying to myself, you know, I worked at McKinsey here in the city for 7.5 years. And when I think abstractly, I can find no distinguishing difference whatsoever between Strange and Tilley on the one hand and a pair of McKinsey consultants out working for whomever on the other hand. That is, they are entrepreneurs and they are a 2-person professional service delivery firm. And so the question I have got in my own mind is, can we not, as I call it, Tom and Joe every job in the corporation? And I think we can. I think we can. Up the hill a little bit, our friends at the Ritz-Carlton won the Baldrige Award a couple of years ago, a miracle in and of itself. The Baldrige examiners all came from the industrial side of the Commerce Department, and they've never met a service industry company that they like, and so every now and then one sneaks through, but it's a bloody miracle when it does. Anyway, the Ritz-Carlton won it. There are a lot of elements to the Ritz-Carlton story. One, which is small, but which is not small, is that when you walk into a Ritz-Carlton and an 18-year-old young man or young woman grabs your bag, one of the things which you probably don't realize is that she or he has the ability, without checking with a supervisor, if you have a problem, to spend on the spot up to $2,000 to solve your problem. That $2,000 being higher spending authority than that assigned to the average vice president in the average company that I work with. Which is to say, when you look at that bellhop at the Ritz-Carlton, you are looking at a de facto entrepreneur who owns her or his 17 square feet of the operation. And that, to me, is key. In fact, Bill Sharland, who is a Denver-based career consultant, imagines a very new form of company. The company he imagines consists of a teeny-weeny tippy-top of managers, a massive set of what he calls service providers in the middle, and then maybe, or maybe not, a tiny bottom tip of the diamond of supporting clerical workers. I say maybe not because, as I'll talk about in a minute, I've come across example after example lately of quarter billion dollar, half billion dollar corporations which have, for example, no secretaries at all. It turns out that even boys can learn to type. It is a new disembodied world where doing it yourself is a mistake because the world consists by and large with an explosive number being added every day of excellent providers of excellent services who will partner with you to do whatever. In 1992, Nintendo booked $5.5 billion in revenues, $1.3 billion in profits, and it came from 892 full-time employees. That's $6 million ahead in terms of sales, $1.5 million ahead in terms of revenue. And other than our good friends in the energy industry, numbers like that are unheard of. Apple Computer is supposed to be the gold standard, and it books $500,000 ahead in sales per year. Nintendo's doing three times that in profit per employee per year. The magic of Nintendo is Nintendo does a few things itself very well and lets whoever on earth is best at whatever do whatever. And that, to me, will be the magical answer for tomorrow. Bob Buckman runs a specialty chemical company headquartered in Memphis, Tennessee. He says quite simply, our strategic advantage lies in the leverage of knowledge. But let's travel from this exceptional company in Memphis, Tennessee, to a little bit closer to home and see what we can find in Redwood City. And in Redwood City, we can find, as far as I'm concerned, the clearest snapshot of tomorrow that I have so far come across. The company books $225 million or so in sales a year right now, growing rapidly. It's called Verifone. It has a 60% market share of credit card authorization hardware and software systems in the U.S., and also does dramatically well overseas. What is this Verifone? What is this Verifone is it doesn't look like any company I've ever seen. The model, quite simply, as it was outlined to me by the chief executive officer, Hatim Tiabji, distributed organizational resources as close to the customer as possible, plus tight, fast information feedback loops. He describes it and calls it, which I love, the blueberry pancake model of organization. Very, very flat, and every blueberry is equal to every other blueberry. His comment about headquarters is very simple in the vernacular. Guess what, sports fans? There isn't any headquarters. Now, he admits that he's trapped in a lie. The Securities and Exchange Commission requires him to put an address on the annual report, and so there is a Redwood City address, but on his dying bed, he would tell you it is a company which has no headquarters. And basically, from a psychological standpoint, from an operational standpoint on a day-to-day basis, that is precisely what he has created. Communicate, 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 says Tiabji. Regular management meetings, regular meetings of everybody at every facility, and Tiabji sets the way. Mr. Tiabji spends 80 to 90% of his time on the road. He books 400,000 miles a year. One third of his employees are on the road at any time, and 35% of all employees at any given minute are actively participating in the email network. The key: every employee virtually has full access to all the information in the organization. Three keystrokes will get the newest employee, the most junior employee, total information about bookings, shipments, prospect status, everybody's travel schedule, personnel data, customized selection of technical material updated daily. And moreover, Tiabji is so fanatic about this that fully one quarter of the employees in the company have been registered with the SEC so that they are allowed to see all of the insider data that would therefore otherwise not be available to them. It is a culture of urgency, he says, with typical understatement. The average manager gets 100 email messages a day, and as their chief information officer said, the rule around here relative to the network is tap in or die. The CIO, of course, of this $250 million Redwood City-based organization lives somewhere out near Santa Fe. Nobody's quite sure where. The one thing that you do not talk about in Tiabji's presence is the hated P-mail. Paper is simply not allowed. The network is it. Everybody is accessible to everybody else via the internet, and most employees' families are plugged in to the internet. The whole thing is done by passing things around electronically in that flat blueberry pancake model. For example, Verifone recently won a big job with a German consortium of banks. The Redwood City project team did its thing. When it came time to go to bed, they passed the entire project off to Taipei. When the time came to go to bed in Taipei, they passed the entire project off to London. London passed it back to Redwood City, and literally a significant, sophisticated proposal was put together in a matter of several hours, which would have taken competitors days, weeks, or maybe longer than that. They did not beat the competition. They embarrassed the living bejesus out of the competition. They did it so well. Tiabji describes the company as completely different. The technology, he says, is not proprietary, but the organizational structure is. It is, he says, a model which is replicable everywhere. The problem, says Mr. Tiabji, and I think he's roughly right, is you can't walk into a model like this halfway. I have spent an inordinate amount of time on a single example. I have spent the time on the single example because it is my belief, it is my contention, whether we're talking about heavy engineering firms like ABB, ASEA, Brown, Bavari, or whether we're talking about Silicon Valley-like firms like Verifone, this will be the norm within the next 10 to 15 years. And that's the nature of a much flatter and faster organization. Work done at Nomura Securities said this: the age of agriculturalization is almost entirely behind us. The French farmers don't know that, but most of the rest of the world does. The age of industrialization is passing behind. We are in the middle, perhaps, of the age of information intensification, the age that is giving all of us fits. And yet, says our colleague at Nomura, that too is passing or shall pass. We are now heading toward what the Nomura analyst calls the age of creation intensification. And what I am mostly concerned about as we meet here today in 1994, flatten the hell out of the organization, yes, link everybody else up with everybody else and give them full access to all information, yes, entrepreneurialize the devil out of them like the Tillies and the Stranges, yes. But at the end of the day, is the organization interesting? Is it spirited? Is it spunky? Is it zesty? Is it exciting? Is it neat? And I'm not sure that many pass the test. Guy Kawasaki was a software developer at Apple Computer. He's now an independent management consultant, writer, etc. Kawasaki, in typically mellow language, says the objective is to turn every employee into a raging, inexorable thunder lizard evangelist. I love that language. I've been issuing challenges now for about the last 4 months whenever I have a seminar. Company money, your own money, leave the seminar, change your card to whatever your name is, and underneath it, raging, inexorable thunder lizard evangelist. Sad to say, I haven't had too many people take me up on it, but I did have one. And you can see the card that I received in the mail, in fact, about 4 or 5 weeks ago. Judith Duval, raging, inexorable thunder lizard evangelist. Very nice. Inc. magazine last July ran an article, and in it was a fictitious letter from determinedly seeking the perfect job to Inc. And here is what she said: I don't want to screw around anymore in a place that's badly managed, poorly run, and so stupid I'm just wasting my time. Or a place where you have to be a vice president to get a window. I want to take my dogs to work at least on Saturdays. And if I break into a chorus of Oklahoma at 4 p.m., I want two people to harmonize with me, not look at me sideways. And so my question is your organization heavy or light, industrial or service, small or large, the sort of place where
if an employee broke into A Chorus of Oklahoma at 4 p.m. with her dog sitting next to her, she would be looked at sideways,
or would she be promoted?
And I would suggest the answer to that apparently silly question is a much better indicator of the ability of the organization to innovate than the answer to any of the more sober questions that we normally get in the world of business. The point of all this is very, 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 very practical. It's practical in terms of that satellite on the back of an elephant that I showed you a minute ago. That is the world. That is the new competition. From everywhere, doing everything, high quality goods, high quality service. In 1981, 2,691 new products were introduced to American grocery and drugstore shelves. Just 10 years later, in 1991, the number had increased from 2,691 to 16,143, or a new product every half hour, whether you need it or not. God bless us. Product quality is better in America. Obviously, that statistic alone suggests that the speed of product introduction has gone up. And yet, about a year ago at Christmas time, based on a comment I had seen in the newspaper, I called a fellow who runs a little retail outfit down in Arkansas somewhere. His name is David Glass, and his little company's called Wall something or other. I don't remember what it is, $80 billion in sales, whatever their name is. And I asked David about his comment, and his response to me was this. He said, more products, better quality, faster than ever, but there is an absolute dearth of new and exciting fashion-forward products. John Sculley, right before he left Apple Computer, said precisely the same thing. He said, the personal computer industry, it's Godfather 4 and Rocky 5. And the question is, in this crowded market where Americans would like to maintain, if not even increase, the standard of living, the productivity edge that we now command in virtually every industry, if we're going to do it, it's going to have to be exciting stuff. As Glass said to me, where is the equivalent of the early Walkmen, the early microwave ovens, the early VCRs, the kinds of products, to use Mr. Glass's language, that sucked the couch potatoes by the millions off of their couches and into my stores? And so that is my concern. My concern is redoubled during the last 12 months, which have had a horrifying side to them in part. I've been called in by office furniture makers, computer makers, packaged goods companies, accounting companies, engineering services firms, training companies, insurance companies, bookseller chains. And every one of them has had the same story. The consumer is tight. The distributor is tight. They want quality at a low price. They won't pay for my goods. My margins are eroding. What we're selling is becoming a commodity. And I'm here to tell you, engineering services firm, retail outfit, or computer maker, I have, and this is what I've said to them, I have not one iota of sympathy. I said it to an audience of 2,500 senior retail executives of the National Retail Federation in New York City back in January. I said, every time I hear you say the customer is obsessed with value for the dollar, I said, what I'm hearing you say is we're plumb out of interesting ideas for things to do, so the only thing we can figure out how to do is copy Sam's on prices. The way you get out of a low-margin enterprise, regardless of whether it is retail, regardless of whether it is engineering or legal services or supercomputers or anything else in between, is to innovate your way out with exciting products. Commodity is a state of mind and a deadly trap. I had a fabulous, wonderful, miraculous, exciting, emotional high a couple of months ago, which is not the way I normally describe the arrival of Fortune magazine. For the last 10 years, if my memory serves me correctly, Fortune has been putting out that list of most highly respected companies in America. For the first 5 years, hardly a surprise, IBM won it, hands down.
And then we know what happened to them. I think they still exist, but it's not that clear. When IBM fell from grace, not surprisingly, they were replaced by Merck. And who could argue with that? Spending jillions of dollars on sophisticated biotechnological research and so on. And then this year, Merck dropped from grace. Replaced by, anybody know? Rubbermaid. Rubbermaid, the maker of plastic doodads. Rubbermaid, and I think it is an honor well deserved, has innovated and innovated and innovated on top of their innovation. They have branded like nobody, probably since Philip Morris or Coca-Cola, their rubber doodads. And they have proven to me, at least decisively, that whenever I hear somebody utter the words, "We have been commoditized," I will turn my ears stone deaf on them. Anything can be differentiated. Anything can be differentiated dramatically. Rubbermaid can do it and supplant Merck. And yet my favorite example is much more homely than that. Harvey McKay, entrepreneur, management guru, writer, and shark lover, recounted a little tale a while back of the ultimate in commodities. A taxi ride from downtown Manhattan out to LaGuardia. I mean, you know, what the hell can you do with a taxi ride, right? I mean, there are clean taxis and dirty taxis. I acknowledge that. And actually, clean is a pretty big deal. But that's, you know, that's the end of my imagination, at least. But Harvey explains. He said, first, this driver gave me a paper that said, "Hi, my name is Walter. I'm your driver. I'm going to get you there safely, on time, and in a courteous fashion." Went on for two paragraphs, says McKay. Can you imagine it? A mission statement from a cab driver. Then he holds up the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and USA Today and asked if I'd like them, so I took them. Next, he offers me a nice little fruit basket with snack foods. Then he says, would you prefer hard rock or classical music? He has four channels to choose among. McKay goes on with his little story for a couple of paragraphs and concludes, you know what? This man makes $12,000 to $14,000 extra a year in tips. You should have seen the tip I gave him. Incredible. I love it. It is a world where if the imagination is applied, you can in fact decommoditize rubber doodads at Rubbermaid at the billion-dollar scale and decommoditize the taxi ride from downtown Manhattan to LaGuardia. This is the test. I live in Vermont part of the year, about half the time, on a 1,300-acre dairy farm. We're proud of our little high-end, high-value-added ice cream makers from Waterbury, Vermont, Ben and Jerry, with a nod to the fact that Dreyer's makes most of their ice cream. Particularly a nod to that. When Ben and Jerry's are considering a new product, they pass it through one critical screen. Is it weird enough? I love that. It would make my day, it would make my week, if two people out of this group would go back to their companies and change. If I were you, I'd get rid of the product development manual, but that's hoping for too much. Change the first sentence to the product development manual. Any new product or service being developed must pass the test. Is it weird enough? It's a logical statement, isn't it? I go back to my first comment. Are the times weird? If the times are weird, then the thing that we most suffer from is the lack of wild and woolly imagination, whether it's cab rides or whether it's the world of ice cream. Ray Norda, the Novell chief executive officer and founder, said there's no way to be careful in this business. The reason that I am proud and delighted to be here is that the nature of entrepreneurialism is economies that aren't careful, economies that try things, economies that can accept failure
on a widespread basis. If we want our corporations to survive in the years ahead, then they too will have to learn inside their walls the lessons that we know of economies in general. Roger Martin, a consultant writing in the Harvard Business Review at the end of 1993, said simply, to compete, companies must burn themselves down every few years and rebuild their strategies, their roles, and their practices. In conjunction with a television show about 5 years ago, I had the opportunity to interview the late Bill McGowan, the MCI chief executive officer who took that marvelous firm to the great level of success that it has achieved today. And Bill turned to me at one point and he said, look at it this way, Tom. He was explaining the radical changes that MCI tends to go through, the complete personality shifts that it manages to execute even at its large size every year or so. He said, it's very simple. He said, in times gone by, the chump to champ to chump cycle was three generations. He said, now it's about 5 years. And I think that is in fact the case. It is an exciting time. It is a time of fabulous opportunity. Yesterday evening, I had the privilege that I have on too rare an occasion to speak to students. I was down at San Jose State University. And I said to them, I am green with envy. By no choice of your own, by blind luck, you young men and women are beginning your careers in the most screwed up time the economy has ever gone through in hundreds of years. I said, when my dad was working as he did for 41 years at the Baltimore Gas and Electric Company, he knew the rules, and the rules made sense. In a placid, tepid environment, the issue was hunker down, keep your nose clean, and for Christ's sakes, don't let them see you, and you can graduate 41 years later with a gold watch, and in his case, a $125 a month pension, whether he needed it or not. I said, tonight, you can do me a favor for this speech that I'm giving you gratis, because I'm not giving it to you gratis. I said, your return to me is, and I said, I know you can't make this promise because it's a statistical request. I want to know that within 5 years of graduation, one third of you has been fired at least once. I said, you are America's best and brightest. And if you're not pushing the limits to the point that you have scars and scar tissue all over your body, then we have wasted our investment on you. It is a time of limitless opportunity. Nothing excites me more than to see a satellite on the back of an elephant in the boondocks in India, because it means that each and every one of us in this country is going to have to work like hell, get a lot weirder than we have been in the past to retain and maybe, if we're lucky, expand the extraordinary position that we have in the global economy. That's true for us as a nation. It's true for us who, in many respects, here in the Bay Area, are in the catbird seat. As somebody, as I said before, who lives in Vermont part of the year, I never understand the stuff that I keep reading in the Eastern press about the demise of California. I cannot imagine any place on earth with greater opportunity and more talent to go after that opportunity. Though I am reasonably happy because we are in the catbird seat, but nobody's talking about it. And that's a rather nice state of affairs, truth be known. So that's my two bits, and I would love to take your questions on anything related to what I said, or stuff that I should have said, or stuff that I meant to say, or what have you. Comments, questions?